Boxtails Theatre Company is unique in a number of ways. First, they perform only original works based on mythology and folk stories. Second, their physical approach combines mime, acrobatics, juggling, dance, Brazilian capoeira, and live music. Next are the masks and the puppetry, strange and wonderful artifacts constructed especially for the troupe. Finally, their pared-down approach balances the spectacle of theater and the intimacy of storytelling. Although based in Santa Barbara, Boxtails is, in fact, a touring professional company, serving surrounding cities, the Bay Area, and even Olympia, Washington. Their website has this statement: "Myths transform us by opening our lives to wonder, to the mystery of the strange, terrible, beautiful universe that is our home. Myths teach us that, as frail and temporary as we are, we have the power of narrative, the power of creating ideas, the power of naming, the power of understanding, and the power of love." In celebration of their 20th anniversary, Boxtails will return to the Libero Theater to stage 4 newly upgraded shows from their repertory this weekend. That will include Prince Rama and the Monkey King. That'll be Thursday night at 8 o'clock. The Odyssey, Friday at 8. Leyendas de Duende, Magical Tales from Latin America, Sunday morning at 11 a.m. And Br'er Rabbit and Other Trickster Tales, Sunday at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. Last week I caught up with Artistic Director Michael Andrews and Company Principals Matthew Tavianini and Marie Ponce to discuss the big milestone. I had the honor of hosting the three of them in my kitchen as they returned to town after performances one morning in Santa Maria. I hope you enjoy this lively, informal, and very informative conversation. Oh, and one more thing. You're going to hear the clink of kitchenware, the filter pump of the fish aquarium, and even the dog drinking from her water dish. But that's all right, because if the message of Boxtails is anything, it's that mythology is all around us in everyday life. So, what does 20 years mean in mythological time?
Oh, you guys. I mean, mythological time itself is used in many, many ways, and its meaning can be variable. So, if we were writing a myth of the Boxtails, if we were creating a myth, and first of all, myth, you know, in a Jungian sense, is... as they say, a dream is to a person, a myth is to a culture. So the myth world is interpreted like dreams are for individuals, for a society. And 20 years for our culture could be, I'm going to say, I'm making this up, of course, but I'm going to say that it could either mean... you could either look at it through the lens of time and larger time. So 20 years is nothing. 20 years is a day. 20 years is a moment. Most stories use time that way, mythological stories. That, you know, on the first day he could speak. On the second day he could walk and run. On the third day he refused his mother's milk, craving meat like all men of his rank. And on the fifth day, he was ready to go hunting in the forest with his father, this time in the flesh, you know, that kind of thing. An example. But I might also look at it in the sense that 20 years is this last 20 years, which is very unique in history, you know, because of the things that have happened and where we are mythologically as opposed to where we were 20 years ago mythologically as a society. And we really pay attention to that stuff. That's what our primary job is, you know, is to pay attention, because what we're trying to do is mine relevance out of these old stories for a modern world, you know. So we're constantly looking at what we're really working on mythologically in our society, and then trying to see if there is help for us in these old stories, which there almost always is. You know, mm-hmm. you know, these stories are around this long. It's kind of like natural selection. Not kind of. It's exactly like natural selection in the sense that a story that is no longer relevant ceases to be told. Right? And so then... And then those ones that are still being told hundreds or thousands of years later clearly have some juice for us still. And we're using them. And that's why we keep telling them. So... Yeah. Or some of them are just so weird and cool that we can't stop telling them something. You know?
Do you see yourselves as partly as translators and bridge builders then? I mean, not only do you have to know the myth, but you have to know what the language of today's language is in order to translate it, like Hermes on the roller skate sneakers.
Mm-hmm. Heelys.
Yeah, Heelys.
Well, that's a great example, yeah. So, we always wanted to make... Hermes Fly, of course, and then we took that cue from the kids, and we figured we'll get that little pop in their consciousness in the beginning. We'll get some buy-in because they'll go, "Oh, Heelys," and they do every single time, and then right away, him flowing across the stage in character takes their attention right into the scene. So, yeah, we try to layer everything so that there's a lot of payoff on a lot of different levels. For a couple of different reasons. One is that we base our work in the innate intelligence of children. We believe that kids are born smart, so we don't want to talk down to them, and we don't want to shame them, and we don't want to act like they're not brilliant, because they are. And so we build complex stuff for their minds because they get it, and they translate complex metaphor as good as well as you and I, and sometimes better, because they don't have intellectual shame yet. And so there's that, and then there's also engagement, just pure fun. There's all this meaningful stuff in there, but also just fun and engagement to have them not go to sleep like people can do in a piece of theater, you know, and gloss over and start to snore. You know, we want them with us. So we try to use little metaphors to. Begin a game of how will they do this and what does that mean, and so it's just a fun little.
It's a little bit of, in a way, training them how to participate in theater again, instead of just a kind of a passive watching what's happening,
like on a screen.
Yeah, which they've been trained to do all their lives from TV.
Right.
And we try to bridge that gap, as you were saying. How do they participate in theater? Their imaginations, with filling in the blanks that we're not giving them, like TV would give them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. A lot of these kids are spending a large part of their day in front of electronic screens. It seems like what you're doing is such an antidote to that. You know, mm-hmm. it's on the ground, barefooted, you know, acoustic. And so that's interesting, because you, if in the abstract, if somebody was to propose that, if they didn't know you had existed, somebody might say, well, that won't work, because mm-hmm. that's not what they're into now.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, I get the sense you guys find almost the opposite, that there's a hunger, that they don't mind getting away from their screens. Or maybe during summer rehearsal you have, put that away, put that thing away.
No, not at all. Not at all. Yeah, I think that this, we call it a metaphoric game, but really I don't have the right language for it, because I think we're still searching to name it, what it is, this thing, this little game we play, because I think it's nothing short of the primary differentiation, well, identification of humans, like the humanness factor, the thing that makes us unique is this game. Is abstract reasoning and metaphor. And we love it. It's our currency, and we love it almost more than anything. We have to remember that these small mouth noises that we're using, that we call language, are an audible metaphor system. Right? They're just small mouth noises. And you have a little dictionary in your head, and I make these small mouth noises, and you make meaning out of those noises in your head. We're so used to it, we don't think of it that way, but it is a symbol system. So is sound, just pure sound, like music. So is movement and gesture. So is color and light. So is, you know, photons, all of it. So we're used to it, we do it. Other animals don't seem to be doing that particular thing, you know, but we do. It is what we do primarily, you know, makes us human. So when we get up there and start doing this, as you say, in the sort of natural feet on the ground, you know, acoustic way, everybody just falls in because we all know how to do this game. Mm-hmm. This is what we love, mm-hmm. you know.
Seems. And it is. There's a language to it. It's almost when you see a subtitled movie and you're focusing on the words, and then all of a sudden you don't realize they're there. You're not reading mm-hmm. anymore. You're just watching
right.
the movie. And I felt that way the first time I saw a Box Hill School show. Mm. Where I thought, okay, it's just, I get this palette that they sort of have, and then you're sort of catching your breath every time because they're changing in a second. Masks are coming on, puppets are coming on, and it's, what's next? And I think it is. You've built this language that's really beautiful and lovely, but you have to jump on the train because here it goes. it's going to take you on a trip, but it's initially not. And we're there, like this morning, we're stretching in our blacks, and kids are like, what's going on? Are you warming up? What are you doing? Well, you'll see. And they do, and it takes off. So I think it's a wonderful language that Foxtails has created.
So. I think that's interesting that you guys do the stretching and your warm-ups in front of the audience.
It's unique, yeah.
It's not that's interesting. That in itself communicates something.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a message. It's on purpose because with the loss is that magical moment of your entrance where...
Right.
And the thing about that is that it has that power of the unknown. You're in control now. And no one knows what you're about to do. And so everybody's quiet, waiting and watching. And you still, even the way we do it, you still retain that. I mean, we often say... Or one of the things you learn as a performer is that if you go up on your lines or you make a mistake in a scene or something like that, you have to remind yourself, they've never seen this before. They don't know that you've made a mistake. So just go with it and see where it takes you. And,
right.
you know, some of the most, you know, valuable things that you discover are in mistakes. No, all of the most valuable things are in mistakes that you learn. But yeah, I think the message is that we're just regular people. Mm. We're not special and we're not different. We're playing a game that is accessible to you.
Right.
That you can play this game and you're invited to play now and with your creativity and your imagination. And if you wanted to get some friends together later and pick a really good story that meant something to you and act it out this way, you could do it with nothing.
Yeah.
Like kids in a sandbox. So that's kind of the message.
That's great. It's like this meta level thing going on there at the very start.
Yeah.
In addition, just showing how important warming up is.
Yeah.
For any athletic kind of activity.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
And pointing that out, that, yeah, just like sports, you know, you perform better and hurt yourself less if you're warm.
Now, are you original in doing that? Have you, in your travels to other countries, have you come across another theater... physical theater group that
doesn't. I don't think I have.
Never.
Yeah.
You?
I don't think so. Not in the same way.
Does your group...
No, it's not... It's not physical. I think there is. There's a language. Box Hills has a language. And this is only my fourth season. I just told a kid that today. Which is really cool. But there's a language. There's a physical language that is used in it, and I haven't seen it anywhere else. I mean, between the acro yoga, yes, but just how bodies are present on stage is different. How stories are told mm-hmm. with your bodies, it's just different.
One of the things that occurs to me is that you yourselves become a symbol. You represent adults who are willing to play.
Mm.
And masks and puppets and musical instruments are like toys. And it seems to me when I think back as a kid, when I would be lit up by a magician or a juggler or a musician, It seems that every kid needs to see adults who still play, because adults often banish play in an attempt to exercise authority, and then play becomes belittled, and it's made into something you're ashamed of, and when are you going to grow up and get serious about all this? So in that way, you guys yourselves become this doorway to something really important, I think.
Yep. I have very little to add to that. That's right.
Really lovely.
That's right.
Really lovely.
It's so important, you know. I mean, I think that we spend, our adolescence getting taught how to be serious, and then take things seriously, and then being credible, and sort of building the ego that's necessary on some level to get things done. And then you spend like the rest of your life, you know, or maybe the interim period is one of, you know, dragging your face on the ground for long enough that you get sick and tired of just being too serious about life, and you realize that like the real power and the serious comes from the back door. It comes in a roundabout way, not directly into the serious, but instead, you know, sort of through serious, increasingly serious approaches to play. You know, that your play is serious play now. It's disciplined play. But it is not dry. It's wet. It is not, you know, it's
vulnerable.
Both fun.
Strong,
but vulnerable. Yeah, strong is vulnerable. Yeah, you start, a lot of dichotomies are set
because
up
that's, I mean, that's fine. That serious thing is it's kind of an armored,
exactly.
There's no chinks in the armor. You're going
exactly.
Ahead. And
I will say this, that word brought up another thought for me too. And some people ask us, you know, after 20 years, and especially the older performers in the group, you know, they're expecting us to be kind of downtrodden and beaten up by this thing that we've done for so long and so forth, and maybe become jaded and all those things that happen and stale. And on the contrary, you know, I feel more vital and alive now than ever before. I feel like we're better at what we do by far than ever before. And it has to do with many things, but one thing most of all, and that is identifying our primary, I'll speak personally, this is for me, identifying more and more clearly my primary responsibility in this work, and that is connection. That my sole purpose for being on the stage, I think that when we first get on stage, you need a certain amount of ego to be able to perform in front of other people.
Right.
You know, and what's happened is that I've stepped further and further and further away from that until at some point I even had to ask myself, so what am I doing here? You know, like, and find a new reason to even be on stage. Mm-hmm. And, you know, now this is what I've found. And it has everything to do with taking the armor off. Like you were saying, you know, the armor comes off and you become completely vulnerable and you reach right out. And it's no longer, you know, I'm performing for the room and if you're there, fine. It's more reaching out and trying to grab a hold of people and bring them into your story and play with them directly. Mm-hmm. And that's when it gets juicy.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
You know, the Dutch graphic artist M.C. Escher, who did all the...
Mm-hmm.
He talks about how he was driven to master all the technique of art and be the best artist in every class he was at and everything. This was what he was doing. And then he really did it. I mean, he became incredible. And then suddenly it hit him. What's it all for?
Mm-hmm.
And then that's when it dawned on him. It was to communicate something. And then it began this whole thing, well, what do I want to communicate and to whom do I want to communicate?
Yeah.
He realized that egotistic passion was simply building an instrument, building him into an instrument, and then he would come to the point. He thought that was the point, and then he realized, oh, this was all just prelude making connections.
That's right. Mm-hmm. That's right. And it's in every art form. I remember realizing that at a Chick Corea concert.
Mm.
That, you know, I'd been so enamored with these guys that can play arpeggios at any, in any, you know, 16th notes in any tempo. You know, I'm so impressed. And then at some point, I was not impressed at all anymore. I thought, you're still trying to prove something to your mother.
Sorry.
And I walked out.
It's juggling. It's
Korea,
juggling.
John Patitucci, all these guys. It's yeah. juggling. It's like, yeah, yeah. lots of
how many balls can he get?
Lots of words. How many balls can he get?
Autoeroticism.
Right?
Speed autoeroticism.
Yeah. yeah. And it happens in lots of art forms where we just stay with the technique
yeah.
long after. You better ask yourself, what does this serve?
Yeah. Right. What's that?
Yeah.
And it makes sense that you'd have a passion for mastering, for getting the instrument together. And that nature may be working purposes in us, of course, all the time, that are beyond us. We don't know what it's for.
Yeah.
But you see that. It's a stage. Now, the older musicians know that. You know, when yeah. Wynton Marsalis was
yeah.
playing with the jazz guys, and he was a hotshot teen, and he was recording the great classical concertos on CBS Masterworks and all that. And he'd go up there and he'd play a gazillion notes, and all the guys around his dad would just shake their heads. You know, they'd really rile him when he got off the stage. They'd say, yeah, man, you know, I think you played more notes in that solo than I played my whole life. And they would put him down, you know, and he eventually got it. You know, he got it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's neat. So that's 20 years. So, yeah, so, you know, if Box Tales is the protagonist in the hero's journey, what's point is he at 20 years? That may be it, huh?
I was just thinking about my time and just how why am I doing this has changed from my just 13 years with being with the company. And I've changed, and the world's changed, and I think I've found a reason, more of a connection now as to why I do this. And I think it has to do with just electronics and how our kids are becoming so out of touch with human connection and communication.
Yeah.
And I'm seeing that, and it's really scaring me.
Mm-hmm.
And so I feel like this work, where we're actually live people on stage looking into somebody's eyes and engaging them in the storytelling, which is the oldest tradition in the world, this is has meaning and has a purpose and has mm-hmm. something I feel like can work and touch these kids so that they still remain wanting to connect to people and not just only stuck in their screens. You know
their resources are in here. They don't always have to be out here. But you must have seen in this span of time doing this, you've been in the midst of this screen revolution. Have you seen the differences in the audiences in schools? I mean, is there something that you experienced differently? Or is it so powerful and different what you're doing that no matter what's gone on with their screens, you find them equally available?
I have something to say.
I
don't want to say it first.
Okay. I think I have seen a difference. And I think how can I put this? I think it comes with the audiences, the school audiences that tend to be more privileged and more wealthier in terms of these resources they have at right. school, they tend to be not as attentive in live. When they see a live performance, they tend to be really scattered and not understanding the kind of the rhythm of the piece, so that knowing when to laugh.
And they're hooked up to algorithms rather than
the natural rhythm.
The Mozart concerto that becomes the timing of our work and the audience interplay that is always there. That's what's so brilliant about, because it's never the same. Not one performance is like another one in terms of that rhythm, that pulse, that mm-hmm. paying attention that we do. Yeah, I would say that your ability to pay attention, that presence and is directly affected by too much screen time. You know, that your ability to focus. Basically, you could say that what they're calling ADD or ADHD, is largely that. That there are maybe some serious, real, you know, chemical cases of ADHD, but many, many of our children now. And it's true what Matt says about affluence. That I will say this too. I think that in the absence of hands-on parenting, you know, and more and more of the hours of the day, literally hours of the day, being taken over by these screens, what you have is a lack of teaching ethics and morals, too, you know, social skills. But I mean, it's just a joy. Like we played Santa Maria this morning.
Today was.
Oh, it was amazing.
It doesn't get any better than that. Wow. It doesn't get any better than that. Those kids are in the zone. They're in the zone. They don't lack anything in terms of ability to connect, ability to interpret what's what, what's right, what's wrong, and how to behave. They know how to behave.
If somebody says that Box Tales is children's theater, is that correct?
Sure.
Yeah, that's good.
We are marketing ourselves as youth and family oriented theater. Mm-hmm. And our primary service is that of children. That's our primary service. And it just so happens that because there's a dividend, you know, this belief in innate intelligence in children, the dividend is that it's complex enough theater that when you look around, what theater are adults going out to see? Well, it's as sophisticated as that. I mean, these are very complex stories with layered meanings, and some of the approach. It's not kiddie. Exactly. It's not kiddie. It's a little bit more akin to the European children's theater. I mean, in Europe, it's been like this for a long time, you know.
Hmm.
I think that in America, we kind of, we developed a high voice with our kids, and we stayed there. We stayed there, you know, from some of those early TV shows when there was one channel and then three channels, remember?
Mm-hmm.
So Howdy Doody and all that stuff, and, you know, some of that stuff was just downright embarrassing. You know, the quality just was not there. You know, and so we, like many things, we're a very young culture. I mean, when I was growing up, we had no good coffee in America, no good bread in America. This was great, thank you. We had no good wine in America. We had pretty much the food was bad. You know, like if you got vegetables, they were packaged or canned or something like that. Remember TV dinners and all of this? So we've had revolutions in all of these things. Now we have great coffee. We have great bread. You can get the best vegetables down at the farmer's market. You know, the wine is world class and stealing the gold in France. And, so we've come a long way, you know. And I think, unfortunately, it's a sin what we're doing with education. And it's political. You know, like we're making choices that are selfish. We are saying, no, we want profit now for us, and we don't want to put the money toward our future and our kids, and we're taking money directly out of education, which seems like the most inane, selfish act imaginable to me.
We're putting college students in debt.
Students in debt. We're saying, you know, I mean, the systems are a little vacuous. I mean, our morally. It's important, and I think the values that old stories that we're telling, they are political in nature. Maybe that the cat's out of the bag. Whoops, I shouldn't have said it out loud. But yeah, we're teaching the kids these values through these stories, and it's nothing like political theater, but boy, it's in there.
Mm-hmm.
Boy, it's in there.
Yeah, it is.
Stories like the Ramayana and the Odyssey, and you know, these stories have a lot of juice in them.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway.
But you never shy away from the juice. That's one thing I will say about Box Tales. Uh-huh. I remember the first time building a show and going, can we say this? Isn't this a little... But it's not. And having that attitude, I think, is the reason that why the company has thrived for so many years is because they don't dumb anything down. They don't talk down to the kids. Mm-hmm. And they bring these stories that are messy and gnarly and ask really important questions and sometimes don't answer them, and that's important. That will scratch the brain of anyone, child or not, more so than handing it on a platter or cookie cutter or Disney-esque
beginning,
middle, end like things. And I
sort of the Grimm's versus the Disney version, right. I was wondering about that, you know, because I remember before the Heroes Twins performance, Michael, you came out and had a little pre-word about, okay, there's going to be some masks, there's going to be this, you know, this, and you were showing solicitation for, you know, avoiding possible trauma that I wondered. First of all, I wondered, ooh, is there a backstory here? You know, has something happened in the past that would be interesting? But so I'm wondering about, you know, the presence of rawness or cruelty or ambiguity in teaching tales. Mm. What is your responsibility towards those elements, and how do you navigate that?
Well, that's a bigger question, but I'll answer the first smaller part of the question first, because that little mask expose in the beginning comes from especially when we're in the schools and kindergartners are present.
Yeah,
there's a huge difference between a kindergartner and a first grader in their investment in their own imaginary world. Mm-hmm. Right between those ages. So a kindergartner believes this is real. And when a big hairy man like me or Maddie comes out there with one of them big nasty masks, it's the boogeyman. It's come, it's real, it's right in front of them, and they can lose it, and we'll have a crier. You know, and first graders, not so much. Every once in a great while, but you don't have to say anything to them. But it really helps with kindergartners to tell them, this is pretend. And it's just me and Matt and Marie and whoever was on stage. You know, we're going to do this game, and we're going to have some scary masks, and it's just fun. It's just for fun. And then once you say that and make a little rapport, develop some rapport with them, then it goes well. So that's where that comes from, and especially at public shows, because public shows, they'll bring their infants. You know, it's a kid's show. Oh, great. So bring your, you know, 7-month-old kid, you know, and they're like, ah. No, actually, the really little ones, they're looking at the lights. Yeah. but there's that little window in there when the masks will terrify them. Can you ask that question again?
The bigger question would be, there's, you know, sort of the Grimm's versus the Disney divide. What if, so there's elements of rawness or cruelty or ambiguity in these tales, and to what degree do you take responsibility for that? To what degree do you want to be a transmitter or a translator? And without depotentiating it, you know, without taking the juice out of it, editing it.
This is one of the most important things of our work, yeah.
I think, do most of the tales, there are cruel parts, like where one character is doing something to another that is cruel, but in the end, there's a through line as to why that happens, and then in the end, it's usually summed up in a moral tale, or
absolutely,
some sort of way that you understand that it's not about that thing that's happening there. It's about the bigger lesson.
It teaches a lesson of value. I was going to say this though. I think that through our work, what we've done studying mythology and how it functions, how it's been used in societies through time, is these have always been. And look at the Bible. I mean, like, here's allegory after allegory designed to teach people something, right? And so it is the most effective teaching tool we have ever had, either in an oral tradition or written. These stories, through story, we teach and learn the best. Mm-hmm. It's the best way, right? Wow. And so with the Grimm, with the darker tales, for instance, like I have a book called Grimm's Grimmest, and in that book, wow, you know, Juniper Tree and... There are always these cannibal tales where there's at least some worry, if not an actual thing, where we eat each other. The father eats the son, or, you know, or some crazy dark thing. And this is what I think. I think that, again, in an effort to cuddle our children and save them from these dark things,
yes,
we omit those... What did Catullus say? Something about his poetry he was being edited. Something about a pumice stone. Shall I take a pumice stone to all these? Mm. So that it would be nice and smooth and glassy for everyone? Would it be more palatable to you then? These things that we speak of are our us. They're our reflection. This is art's primary function, right? So you want a real, or do you want a polished version of that? Mm. Because art has a function. And when you're using the whole picture with the dirty laundry included, then you can stand to learn something about yourself. You're taking a real look at humanity. And you can grow from that. And if you take all that stuff out, you cannot grow from it, and its value's gone. It's been taken out. It's been stripped. The value is stripped with the darkness. And I think they knew from I think that they, in Europe, in older cultures, you know, in general, understood the capacity of children to hold on to the darkness. That children, from a very young age, are absolutely moral creatures. Deeply moral creatures. I mean, more so than you and I. You start at about 6 and 7. I mean, you interview a child about morality, and they will give you a telling of about what's what. You know, and they have, they're on, there's a study recently about this. But, yeah, they can handle and grapple with that darkness, and they need to, because loss is as real for a child as it is for you and I. And that's why in all these stories, you know what happens? Like in the first act, usually in the first sentence, mother dies. They kill the mother. Ah, done. She's gone. Now what? What are you going to do about it?
Yeah.
You know, in the European tales, it's just like every single one, the Grimm's tales and the Italo Calvino and the Italy and all these European tales. That's its point.
That's our job.
You know, like, and when we did with the kids in the summer, when we did Little Mermaid, we, on purpose, we went directly to Hans Christian Andersen's original version, which doesn't end like the Disney version. You're like, yay! You know, it's got some complex problems, and we then, with more time, with 3 weeks to talk with all these kids about what they're reading into that story, what they think is happening in that story, what they think is important about that story. You know, we collaborate with them and come up, we make those choices. How we're going to end it and stuff was up to them, and they were deeply into that stuff. This is 8 to 12 year olds we're talking about. So, you know.
Yeah, it seems like, yeah, we should ask ourselves the question of what's the cost of sanitizing.
Yeah.
Stuff like that. And if you look at the culture and the American culture in the 50s and the 60s, we were, those, you know, after the post-World War II trauma, the World War II trauma, then they tried to offer the Father Knows Best America. But I think what happens is you don't know what to do with your darkness then.
That's right.
Because no one's admitting they have it on the surface.
Right.
And you don't, and then so that creates this terrible self-estrangement.
And for the country, like for
shame,
instance,
and then reactions. And
what you do with your vets, for instance.
Yes.
You know, like when they were coming back from the Vietnam War, and we were saying, hero, hero, and they were not contextualizing any of this.
Yeah.
And so they ended up in Canada. You know, like, I cannot come home. And when you talk about the hero's journey and the coming home and how important that is, like, the door into the house is a very important threshold. You know, if you can't go inside, and these are true, actual, I mean, I'm talking metaphorically, but there are a lot of stories about guys who couldn't sleep inside their houses for a long time. Or, you know, they camp out in the yard. They had a hard time re-entering.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that this culture, you could say, clearly doesn't know how to mourn, for instance. Not properly.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and I will again say it's the power of storytelling. If you don't know how to tell the right story symbolically, then that's a big problem. So if you're just saying, these guys are heroes, period, I think that's an important part of the story, to make those guys heroes. And it's not the whole story by any stretch, and that's the problem. Those guys, that was too small a story for them to live out of. You know, they were coming back from having killed people.
Yeah.
And
that's right.
There's a story Michael Meade tells about, he's doing work in a prison down south in Louisiana, men's work. And it's just outside of a prison. I forget exactly where it was, but he's got this group of people. He's got native people from the reservation, a lot of darkness there. And he's got gangs who are gangbanging and killing people there. And he's got these guys that came off of death row who were released from the local prison. And the first thing that's weird is the populations are like looking at each other like they're going to kill each other. You know, you got Native Americans, and everybody's hating each other. And then pretty soon, as soon as they start opening their mouths and talking to each other, they realize, these are my brothers, you know, like, the only person in the world who can understand me, right? Because they share this thing of this, all this darkness. But there was a group of three guys off of death row who for 3 days they held back and they separated themselves out and they would not assimilate. And finally one of them, a sentinel, you know, was sent out to say, I think it was Michael Mead pushing them, like, look, you gotta be a part of the group. You gotta be a part of this. If you're gonna be here, you gotta be part of it. And what they worked out was the ritual. What they decided they had to do, I'm about to lose it, was they had to wash the feet of every man there. So they lined those guys up, and these death row guys, they just wanted to wash their feet before they could enter the room, right? So it's a ritual. You have to have some way of getting back here and feeling each other, you know?
And that was physical. It wasn't words. It couldn't be done symbolically with words. And you guys are all into the physical dimension of theater. Physicality in theater.
Yeah. Talk about some ritual theater, right? Yeah.
Let's take a ladder out of the deep stuff for a moment.
Yeah.
Tell just some mechanical questions, some overviews. The different dimensions of Vox Tales now, you have the programs you bring into the schools. You do public performances occasionally. You've got, what else is
there? A lot, actually. We're just on tour a lot.
Yeah.
We do public performances here occasionally.
We're center stage or whatever.
Yeah.
And, you might... But the heart of the thing right now is the school program. Sounds like
assemblies and residencies in school.
Residencies where then you're doing workshop. You like it's like a mini summer camp in a way.
Exactly.
And you're trying to get them to they're going to do a performance themselves, so they're going to participate in something. Right.
Yeah. Residencies are also 3 week. Not 3 week. They're just 12 site visits, and in schools, and then we have 3 week summer camp. And I don't know, touring is still, it's not as big as it was. We used to do 150 shows a year on the road.
Did you?
Yeah, and now we're down to more like 60, something like that. But we still go, you know, in the western states, we're still working up in Washington and the Bay Area and all over Southern California down to pretty much the border. And and a lot of those tours will have like a... you know, big theater, one or two or three anchors, and then we'll do school shows around there. Mm. You know, so we'll go for a couple weeks.
Okay.
Sometimes the Center for Performing Arts in Washington, Olympia, they're a great gig. They have us for 2 weeks straight in that Center for the Performing Arts. This big, beautiful, you know, theater, and they bus in 1,500 kids a day. You know, in that program, and so yeah.
That's awesome.
A lot of that kind of...
Yeah, but this is a story we don't get to hear often. I mean, we see that when you're here and you don't realize your outreach and what's going on. That's
great. We're creating a lot of school districts and a lot of neighborhoods. And
now, is it... you seem to, at least on the webpage, you seem to have an enviable... you've built up an enviable group of donors. And is that... you know, is something like going to Washington, is that entirely paid for, or did they have to pay for something? How does that work?
Those are good contracts. You know, they pay pretty well and make it worth our while financially to go up there. It is harder and harder. I mean, but part of learning the business as arts entrepreneurs, you know, you have to really figure out what the price points are. Theater, under any circumstances, whether it's educational or not educational, doesn't make enough money in our society to float. So it's always subsidized, or it's not professional. It's a thriving community theater scene,
right?
And then there are those people doing it professionally. They are subsidized because ticket sales would never cover it.
Right.
You know, so this is just in our culture and the way our financial world is set up. It's philanthropy that keeps that ball going.
Okay, talk a little bit about the festival. Oh, I know. Well, it kind of leads into the festival's going to be at the Libero, and the Libero is very dear to Box Tales for a long time, right? Mm-hmm. So say something about the relationship between the Libero and Box Tales, and then about, four performances in 4 days.
Yeah, so 20 years ago, 1994, Nancy Lynn was the executive director of the Libero, and at that time, I think she and Sheila Ehrman and a board member, Marlon Bernstein, were really just discussing the problem of the money going away from arts in the schools and what to do, you know, and as an institution, you know, with, you know, to do with the performing arts. They thought, look, what can we do for the schools? Let's put together an outreach program from Libero. It'll be a literary arts outreach program, and we'll put it in the schools. And so they raised some money, and they got in touch. Also sitting on the board at that time was Joseph Velasco. And Joseph said, yeah, I've got this buddy, Michael Katz. He's a storyteller, and I'm a movement artist trained by James Domlin at UCSB, I think. We can probably put something together for this. So they were given $1,000 to put together a show, to build a show that would go out and to the schools. And then those guys knew about me. One of the myths is that they found me after a naked drumming party at the beach under a big pile of kelp on the beach. And that's where they found me. Should we say more? But yeah, they knew that I was doing all this work with indigenous instruments and ritual stuff, and so they said, "Yeah, we need music. Let's get that guy." And so then we went into the studio and started creating our first show, which was "How Did That Get Here?" Creation myths from around the world, and. So that first year, it was just the thought to do that one show. And it was so successful that we did it again and again and again. And so, yeah, we were artists in residence at the Libero for, you know, most of those 20 years. And you know, serving as an outreach program of the Libero for most of that time. And then grew beyond all of that.
They had, like, literary arts. I mean, it was the title of their program. It was something like Libero Theater Literary Arts, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, under their youth programs.
Under youth programs.
Yeah, yeah. And over the years, there was us, and there was a dance company, Jerry Pearson's dance company, and other things off and on. But we were kind of the stalwarts of that program for the Libero forever.
Yeah. Are you three the kind of right now the heart of Boxtails? Are there other personnel?
There are other personnel, but I'd say we're the heart.
Yeah.
Because yeah. Marie now has, what is it, three shows with us?
I think so.
Three different shows. So we have, in rep, we have five shows. And really four shows that we do the most. Or is it five and six? No, it's five shows total with Iron John, right? Mm. Yeah. No, it's six, because we're doing these four. There's Hero Twins and Iron John.
Oh, yeah.
So we have six shows in rep, and really these four that we're doing at the Libero are the most popular ones. But we've got a Mayan show based on the Quiche Maya, mm-hmm. the Popol Vuh, also with Marie. So how many shows are you in?
Three.
You're in three shows.
Just do the math.
And then Maddie and I do one on our own, and then the other two have two different gentlemen in them, David Guerra. Is in Leandes de Wende, Magical Tales of Latin America. And Brian West is in Prince Rama and the Monkey King, and he played Prince Rama in Om, our first big stage incarnation of that. Yeah, he was in that show with us.
They're both wonderful.
Yeah. They're locals?
Both from LA.
LA, okay.
Yeah.
And Jeff has gone on, he's busy being Mr. Professor, right?
So yeah, he's Professor teaching Jeff. Movement at UCSB, and I have to say we're honored that he refers to us often in his work and is kind of teaching the Boxtail style out there. And so that's that feels really good. It feels really good that we were able to do something that we can pass on in that way, and it's great that he's doing that. And it's really an honor that he even says it like that, because his pedigree is so great. I mean, he's had the world's best teachers, but I think growing through Boxtails, growing up with us, you know,
yeah.
he really latched onto a lot of the different, the ways we synthesize. You were saying how unique and we are, and I gotta say humbly that we have drawn from all these different traditions and people that went before us and have been taught by master teachers that, you know, we have a certain way of putting things together that's unique to us, but, you know, and so as artists, we're individuals, but really we're just jacks of a lot of trades and, you know, like, try to have all that great mastery rub off on us if we can, you know, but that's it.
A few years ago, you decided to start doing things bilingually.
Many years ago.
Early on.
15 years ago, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, our first bilingual piece was Mitos y Cuentos. Magical Tales of Latin America? No. Something like that. They're all blurring together for me now. Mitos y Cuentos was also directed by Sigfrido Aguilar, who was a master teacher of ours. And also, Joseph originally studied with him, and then I studied with him. No, then Maddie studied with him, and then I studied with him down in Guanajuato, Mexico. And, mentor, like James Donlan, you know, really important to us. And we brought him up that time to direct in the back of the Libero, Mitos y Cuentos. Mm. And so he did that show. Then we went down for Leandas de Duende, went down to work with him in his studio in Guanajuato. For Leandas de Duende, our other bilingual piece, our third bilingual piece, actually, because we've now got the Hero Twins.
And Tio Conejo,
yeah. Tio Conejo came originally from Mitos y Cuentos. Oh,
right.
Yeah.
Deciding to perform bilingually, did that open you up to certain funding channels that had not? I mean, was it partly a funding motivation? Was it partly to reach the kids on the east side in Santa Maria and et cetera?
Yeah, we were just aware that it was like 49% of the schools at the point we built that show.
Yeah.
It's now like 51% in the schools or 52% in the schools Latino. And or even you could say, I don't know what the exact percentage is, but English as a second language is, you know, I think up there about 50%. So it was just a question of service, you know, that these are our neighbors. You know, these are our neighbors, and if you're gonna be a stinking monolingual society, you know, like at least, you know, try to pick up a language of your neighbor a little bit, you know, and serve in that. You know, I would say that, in fact, when what was the proposition where they were gonna, you know, either they were voting on either doing bilingual education in the schools or not? Do you remember what that was? Mm-hmm. And what year that was? In any case, we voted it down. We decided we wanted to stay monolingual. We couldn't believe it. And there was some talk about that. But what we ended up finding was when we went into the schools, they were not going to teach it. They were not going to try to do dual immersion, you know, that kind of style. But when we went into the schools and performed bilingually, we got no blowback from the administration. But instead, what we got was the kids were really aware of what was going on. So they felt, what the kids actually felt was is that their language was outlawed. Now, that's not true, of course. It wasn't at all. It was just kind of, it was more complex than that. But that's how they felt about it. And so when we opened up our Spanish mouths, you know, Spanish language mouth and started speaking Spanish, there were often these big reactions by the kids. Yeah, they were like, whoa. And they look at each other like, whoa. Contraband language.
Yeah,
it's a fun culture to be because it's so close to home in so many ways. Eyes will light up.
You see it. You can see
absolutely.
It.
Absolutely. Second in narration, or if they preface and say, you know, this show is in Spanish and in English, and you're like, yes.
Oh, neat.
All you have to do is
it's almost like you're calling their name home.
Yeah, right.
You know, it's like, oh, this is about me. This is not one more thing I have to endure. That's, you know, that's amazing.
It's beautiful. Yeah, today you said, from our neighbors from the South Mexico.
And they all went, oh, Mexico.
Yeah. It's cool.
That's sweet.
It's really amazing.
Where do you want it to go for in the next 20 years? I mean, have you thought of expanding it? You know, Boxtails franchise, you know, do you want to tour Europe? Do you want to do a tour of the East Coast? Do you want to?
Yeah, expansion. That's it. One of the things that, I mean, this is our 20th anniversary, and we wanted to honor it in the way that all of this sounds. But the other thing that's true is that I think it was 2 years ago, the Hutton Foundation gave us a grant, and it was a sustainability grant. And they were asking us to ask hard questions and figure out how we could be more sustainable. And one of the things that we did with that is we did a kind of a national discussion with all kinds of big potentates in the industry, and got a lot of smart people who are more knowledgeable about this business than we are to look at us and tell us things. And there was a international conference for youth theater that we went to a couple of times. And in one case, sent all our materials to this judging panel. And the feedback that we got was that, wow, you know, clearly once you get people in a room, you know, they're buying your magic. As marketers, we actually find that you know, using less in terms of props and costumes and bodies on the stage and sets and all and lights and all of that different stuff helps us in our job enlisting your imagination to tell the tales, right? And to make it an engaging situation. So that's power for us. But then you send the 8x10 glossy to the marketer and he's like, what? What show? I can't sell this. And then nobody knows what Boxtails is and this looks like junk. You know, so that's what they told us. They said, lose the little postage stamp backdrops. They make it look like a cafetorium show. Get a light package on this thing. Let's get some stage magic going on. And can you put some costumes in this thing? Basically. And then I want some really high-res photos and some really highly skilled editing on your video. And pa-pa, you know, we'll book you. You'll get a lot more bookings that way. And so acting on that, the Hutton gave us another grant the following year to follow up on this stuff. And so this 20th anniversary festival is also an opportunity where we're taking these four shows and we're putting a lot of time and energy into designing new lights for them, new costumes for everything. We're expanding the shows that weren't previously expanded to an hour. And they're all kind of fully theatricalized and tooled up now. And we're going to shoot them all with a 5-camera shoot and get them all, get all those materials. So right. That's all happening. So be part of history.
Yeah.
Come down. You'll be part of the taping of all of this. And then, of course, so hopefully our marketing will go, this is finally back to your answer. We hope to expand. We want to tour to bigger theaters, further and wider. And yes, European tours. And yes, East Coast. One of the things I'll say is this. In order to tour these things, the touring shows, they're the smaller shows that went into schools. And then a 60-minute, what we're calling full-length piece, because the market, when you do youth and family audiences in these big theaters, that's what they want. That's they want a 60-minute piece. It's not too long,
right.
And yet it's big enough. And they want to be able to afford it. And so based on the economics of touring, we ended up with three people in all the shows. You know, so some of those, what we're going to now call studies, the original Odyssey was a study because we couldn't take it on the road. It cost too much.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, if you got $25,000, we'll bring that show and set it up. Nobody does have that money. So we couldn't tour that. And then same thing with the Ohm, An Indian Tale of Good and Evil. I think we have 13 in that cast. So and a dedicated musician and all that stuff, and that could never have gone on the road. So it was really fun, and we learned a lot. But I will say this. As we restage these things, I think they get better. There are some losses, like the aerial silk stuff that we did in the Odyssey. That was great. I wish we were still doing that. But it would take an extra tech bay everywhere you go. So it would like double the price. You know, so you can't do that. We replaced all that stuff with really cool floor work that's really physical in that show. So I'm really proud of that work. But I think that the primary thing, the storytelling, The story that we're telling and how we're telling it gets better and better. And these shows, I think that you might say that is a little bit gratuitous, especially with Ohm. Ohm was too long. It just needed to be cut and edited and made. You know, some of the tangents were worth it, and some of them weren't. And we explored a lot of stuff with that script. And I think the script we've got now is tight and good, and just we got right to the core of that story. And it takes a while to get to the core of a story and know what's really important to you. And you know, so we're lucky to be able to go back into the studio and relook at these things and get better at what we do. You know. Yeah, so these shows are definitely going to be pleasing to an adult audience, a kid audience, whatever. They're ready. They're road worthy, and therefore ready to come home and share with our community.
Road ready.
Yay!
Yay! You've been listening to Direct Talk Radio. Interviews with directors and performers in the performing arts. My guests this week have been artistic director Michael Andrews and principal performers Matt Tavianini and Marie Ponce of Boxtails Theater Company. For more on Boxtails, visit www.boxtails.org. That's BOXTALES. I'm Joseph Miller. Thanks for listening. To learn more about Direct Talk Radio, or to listen to other archived interviews, visit www.therightjoe.com. That's THEWRITEJOE.com.